Hello, this is a continuation of the December 4th, 2008 lecture for Physics 142. The file that I'm going to be referring to will be labeled P142 Thin Lenses, and the reason it's different is because I found that to do thin lens drawings was sort of a pain, and so I finally went and created a PowerPoint presentation out of it a couple of years ago, and I'm just referring to that. So in particular, I have listed at the bottom of page 1 the photo sources for some of the fun pictures that I'm going to show you, and much of the optical drawings and treatment, actually I use Giancoli, which you can find in the PAS library if you wish, although basically all the same material is in Ohanian. So let's go to page 2. We've talked a little bit about thin lenses, and on the upper piece you see convex lenses or converging lenses. Basically the idea with the converging lens is that it's thicker in the middle than it is on the outside, and you can imagine what it causes the light to do as it passes through is converge toward a point, which we call the focal point, if the light's coming from infinity. So on the right-hand side, you have a converging lens. Most magnifying glasses are converging lenses. And so if you're into burning ants, you use a converging lens, which basically takes light from a large area and focuses it down to a point. And when you do that, of course, you've increased the intensity dramatically, and it's not very good for ants. So in order to think our way through thin lenses, typically people use ray diagrams. So at the bottom of page 2, you'll see a typical ray diagram for a converging lens. These are not just randomly drawn lines, all right? So we have an object which is labeled O. Typically, objects and images look like little vectors. In this case, the orientation of the vector tells you whether the object is upright or inverted. So you can imagine having a pencil sighted at position O with the point going upward. And then we draw three rays. And what do we have on this axis that bisects the lens? We have two things labeled F. Those are known as the focal points for the lens. Every lens will have a focal length, and different strength lenses will have different focal lengths. All right. So let's look at the rays of light coming from the object at point O. One of them, which is labeled number 1, we say comes from infinity. That is, it is coming in parallel to the axis that the lens is sitting on. Okay, so if you can imagine having an object that is way out there, you know, on the other side of a field, all the rays of light coming from that object are going to be coming at you in a straight line. And that's why we say that the rays coming parallel to the axis that the lens is sitting on basically are coming from infinity. Only objects close to you, if you have light coming from a point on an object that's close to you, those rays of light will be diverging as they enter your eye. But if that point is far enough away, the rays of light may still be diverging, but you can't see that. They look parallel as far as you can tell. So anyway, ray 1 is coming from infinity, and in ray diagrams for a converging lens, if a ray is coming from infinity, it then goes through the focal point on the other side. That's what we mean by a focal point. Basically, is if I had all of the rays coming in from infinity, they all get focused at the focal point, and that's the distance you want to hold the lens from the ant when you want to burn the ant. Okay? So if we look at the object at point O and we follow ray 1, ray 1 is coming from infinity, parallel to that axis, and it gets bent, converging, so it gets bent toward the normal or toward the central line, and it goes through the focal point. Ray 2 comes from the tip of the object, goes through the focal point on the left-hand side of the lens, but now it's going to be bent, and it's going to come out on the other side toward infinity. Ray 3 goes straight through the middle of the lens, and basically it will hit glass-air interfaces that it'll be parallel to the normal axis, so it doesn't get bent at all, and it goes straight through. Now notice that these three rays come together at a very particular point on the other side of the lens, and that is where the image of the object is formed. So the rays that came from the tip of the object will meet again at the position of the image labeled I on the axis. Now, note that it is on the other side of the axis. So basically, if your object is a vector like we have at O, it's inverted on the other side. So we talk about object distance, image distance, and whether the object is, and whether the image is upright or inverted. So let's go to page 2. If you have concave lenses, they're thinner in the middle. So examples of diverging lenses are on the upper part of this slide, 3. And now let's look at a ray diagram for a diverging lens. In a diverging lens, if you imagine all of the rays coming from infinity, they all get bent away from their initial direction because the rays have to be diverging after the lens. But note, if you extrapolate back to the left-hand side, the bent rays, all of those extrapolated rays hit at the focal length on the left-hand side of the lens. So that's how you know how the ray is bent when it goes, in these drawings, when it goes onto the right-hand side, is that if you extrapolate back the direction of that, ignoring the lens, it will pass through the focal point if the ray came from infinity. So let's go to page 4 and look at a typical ray diagram for a diverging lens. We now have three rays of light again coming from the object at point O. Ray 1 is coming from infinity, and as we just learned, it gets bent away from the axis that goes through the center of the lens in such a way that if you extrapolate it backwards, that ray would pass through the focal point. Ray 2 heads straight from object O and is heading straight at the focal point on the right-hand side of the lens. It will be bent so that it comes out headed parallel to the axis, or it goes to it's headed to infinity if it would have passed through the focal point on the right-hand side. Ray 3 goes through the center of the lens, and it is not bent. Now, these three rays are diverging, so they do not meet on the right-hand side. So what does it mean when you talk about having an image? Well, these rays enter your eye, and you ask, what does your eye see? What your eye sees is an image as if the rays came from where the image is on the left-hand side of the diverging lens. You extrapolate the rays backwards from their directions that they have on the right-hand side. You extrapolate them back into the left-hand side and see where they meet. And that's what your eye sees. That's what the light looks like to your eye after it passes through the lens. So that's where your image is. So a typical diagram for a diverging lens is where your object is outside of the focal position. You will have an upright image, which is not real. We call it a virtual image because you can't really focus it on a piece of paper, right? What it looks like to you, it looks like it does because the rays of light look as if they're coming from that image, but the rays of light do not really pass through that image on the left-hand side. right? It's only these extrapolated virtual rays of light toward the back that do the that meet at the image. So we call that one a virtual image. If we look back on page 2, that image we call a real image because the light actually passes through that point. You could place a piece of paper at that point and you would get an actual image. So let's go back to page, let's go to page 5 now. Typically, physicists talk about focal lengths in meters. Doctors and optometrists and stuff tend to talk about the power of lenses in diopters. And the power in diopters is just 1 over the focal length when you put the focal length in meters. And it's going to be a positive number for a converging lens and a negative number for a diverging lens. Now, one of the things that it's good to do is to sort of have a measure of the power of the lens is something which is called the magnification. So the magnification is a measure of the size of the image relative to the size of the object. So on the upper left-hand side, you can see that we have an image of height h0 and an object of height hi, and the magnification is going to be h sub I over ho. You can actually look at similar triangles and look at the distances d0 and d sub I, the distance, object distance and the image distance respectively, and you'll find that you can actually also write the magnification as minus the image distance over the object distance. Now you might wonder, where does this minus sign come in? Well, we're going to get to that in a minute. There's a convention. There's an equation that we use throughout thin lenses, which is called the lens equation. We're very original with that. It says that 1 over the object distance plus 1 over the image distance is equal to 1 over the focal length. That's a very simple equation. You will use it all the time. There's one hard part to this thing, okay? Maybe 2. But one piece is if you have to go to page 7, you have to use conventions for the signs of the image distance, the object's distance, and the focal length, okay? The convention that I'm using in these slides is from Giancoli, and if you look it up in the library, it's on page 841. But you will also have those conventions in Ohanian, and I believe they should be the same because typically they are in physics books. Focal length is positive for converging lens, negative for diverging lens. If we have a we say that the object distance is positive if the light, if it's on the side of the lens where the light is coming from, as a way to think about it. The image distance is positive if it's on the other side of the lens from the direction that the light is coming. The image distance is positive for real images and it's negative for virtual images. The height of the image is positive when it's upright and it's negative if the image is inverted. The height of the object is positive if the image is upright and negative if the image is inverted. I keep saying that incorrectly. The object is always taken to have positive height. The image height is positive if it's upright and negative if it's inverted. And the upright and inverted is with respect to what the object was. All right. So if you look at page 6, you can imagine, depending on where your object and image are, you have to worry a bit about these conventions. I've assigned some problems, and that's where you're going to have to learn to get used to these conventions. it really is algebra outside of that. The other trick, which we'll see in a moment, is if you have multiple lens systems. So, for example, I have light that passes through two or three different lenses. The light that passes through the first lens will create an image. The position of that image is the object for the second lens. And that image could be at either side of that second lens. So these conventions start to get a little tricky when you have a multiple lens situation. So those are the problems you'll want to pay close attention to, because you'll almost certainly see one on the final exam. Probably should have put in an example here, but I didn't have one set up. So I don't know, I'm forgetting whether we have one later or not. Okay, so these lenses are very near and dear to you. Your eye is a lens. On page 8, on the left-hand side, if you take an eyeball and cut it, you have something that looks like this. I think you won't find the labels there, but you'll see something that looks sort of like this. And you'll see a couple of things. One is up at the top, you have the cornea, which is basically an interface of the eyeball with air. And if we imagine that the cornea is more or less water, this is like a water-air interface, and you note that it is curved. So that acts as the surface of a lens. In addition, inside the eye, we have an actual lens, which has a higher index of refraction than the water like liquids that are all around it. So, and that lens is such that it's hooked to muscles that can actually change the shape of the lens. So this is what's so cool about it, is you can actually change the focal length of your lens on the fly. And your eye is doing that all the time. And it's doing that in such a way that hopefully the image of the light is focused on the back of the eye, where you have a sensitive place to pick it up. So on the right-hand side, not all eyes are perfect. I went through most of my life quite nearsighted, and I had my eye corrected via LASIK. I have a video I would have shown if I'd given this lecture in class, if I'd thought to. Anyway, in a nearsighted eye, the lens is a little bit, converges a little bit too much. And what happens is that in order to correct the vision, you need to put a diverging lens in front of it and basically cause the light to focus at the back of the lens. If you have a far-sighted eye, you need to put a converging lens, because you need to shorten the point where the light focuses. You can look at somebody with glasses, and if their glasses look really thick in the middle relative to the outside, so sort of Coke bottle lenses, that person's very farsighted. If you see that the outside of their lens is thick, and thicker than in the middle, if sort of the outside edge of their lens looks really big and thick, then it's likely that the person is nearsighted. So if you go to slide 9, again, we talked about aberrations a little bit on the lower right. Remember that because you have a frequency dependence in the index of refraction, red light and blue light will have different focal lengths, actually, for a lens. And this is will cause some blurring in images, which is known as chromatic aberration. Also, in a typical thin lens, you might have a little bit of spherical aberration, which is that you have rays from a point. They will be focused at slightly different directions, and that focusing will be a function of radius, and that's known as spherical aberration. There are lots of other different kinds of aberrations, and one of the jobs of people who do optics for instruments and companies is to get rid of a lot of these types of aberrations, and you can do that with other lenses and combinations of lenses. So let's go to page 10. Of course, electromagnetic waves come with many, many different frequencies, different wavelengths. And visible light, which our eye is sensitive to, is a fairly small range of electromagnetic radiation, ranging from around 400 nanometers to about 700 or 800 nanometers. And the relative sensitivity of our eye is, the curve is given on the bottom of page 10, and you can see that our eye is most sensitive in the green. Now, what the world looks like to us is a function of our eye's sensitivity folded in with the illumination. So if you look on page 11, you can see on the upper left the frequency curve, the relative intensity of light at different wavelengths for daylight, and how that compares with incandescent lamps on the lower left and fluorescent lamps on the right-hand side. And if you ever go out and buy fluorescent lamps, you'll find that you not only have to specify, you know, the base, the way it connects to the electrical world, but also and the wattage, which defines basically the power output, you also will have to define the color or the temperature, which basically is telling you where is the peak of this curve on the right-hand side. And you can buy fluorescent lights, well, and incandescent lights, that are colder or more blue or warmer. And they can be putting out the same power, the same basic integrated intensity, but you can change the spectrum. If you ever play with Photoshop with digital cameras, there's a setting where you can make adjustments digitally for the conditions under which the picture was taken. And it's really a lot of fun. If you go into Photoshop and you take the default setting from a digital camera and you, within Photoshop, tell it that, for example, this picture was taken on a cloudy day or this one was taken in bright sunlight, and you get the correct setting, it will rebalance the colors to agree better with what your eye should have seen at that time, because the default settings don't have it quite right, because the camera doesn't know exactly what the incident wavelengths are. And it can make a big difference in the actual picture. It can be quite cool. Okay, so let's go to page 12. There are lots of eyes in the animal kingdom. The human eye is at the bottom. There are eyes that basically are like pixel systems almost, like the compound eye and C. There are also pinhole type eyes where you really don't have a lens, but you just have a hole that light goes through. But that will, if you have a thin hole, you can form an image just like happens with a pinhole camera. And you can have sensors basically on the back, which is what these animals do. Many insects have these large compound eyes. You can almost think of these as a pixel system of sensitive elements. I thought this was sort of fun on page 14, where you can take what a bee nominally, supposedly sees in the world for some sort of target or a picture of Einstein. Things look quite distorted relative to what you and I would perceive. On page 15, what is plotted is the resolution of the eye, and these different types of eyes are sensitive to different size things. Resolution basically is a measure of your ability to distinguish two points of light or two objects. And the better your resolution, the better your ability to see objects that are closer and closer together. And if you look at the plot on page 15, you can see the resolution as a function of body height. And what you find is that objects that are taller have to have better resolution in their eyes. So if you're wanting to see danger or food and you're a tall beast, you need to have pretty good eyesight. And if you're an insect and you're down amongst lots of things, your resolution doesn't need to be so good. So that's just an interesting lesson in evolution, I suppose. So another aspect of evolution, nocturnal animals have eyes that look like what you see on page 16, because these animals have to let in a lot of light. And of course, if you've had your eyes dilated, or you've watched somebody come in out of the dark, and you actually will see the iris rapidly closing down because your eyeball lets in too much light. One of the coolest eyeball that I know about in the human, in the animal kingdom, is on page 17. It belongs to this Anableps minnow, where the eye is structured so that it can see well both underwater and above the water. And the minnow actually sits where the water-air interface basically bisects the eye. And the eye has two holes, one that's below water, one that's above water. And the two holes see different orientations of the lens. And one orientation is set up so that you can clearly see things in the air, and the other orientation is set up so that you can clearly see things in the water. And so this cool minnow can see above and below the water simultaneously and clearly, which I think is absolutely fantastic. So, at any rate, let's go to page 18. One object that's very interesting and useful is just a basic magnifying glass. And the idea with a magnifying glass, if you look at the lower left hand, there is something which is called, the lower left-hand corner of page 18, there is something which is known as the near point for normal eyes. What is the near point? If you put your finger, you put it directly out from your eye as far as you can reach, and you just hold it up. And now you move your finger in closer and closer to your eye until it fuzzes out and you can't see it very well. That last point where you can focus on your finger fairly well is what is known as your near point. It's basically the distance from your eye which is the closest your eye can focus. Everybody's near point is a little bit different, but on average for a normal human it's about 25 centimeters, and so that's sort of the typical number that people throw around. So if you wanted to see something big, there's a leaf out there and you want to look at it as closely as possible, well, without any aid, you can put it as close as, on average, 25 centimeters from your eye. You can't get it any closer and be able to see anything. If you look at what happens if you put a magnifying glass or a converging lens between you and the object, you get the situation that you see at the top, on the top drawing on page 18. Basically, if you put the object, you can bring the object to almost the focal point of the lens, okay? And what that means is that the rays of light from the object are perceived by your eye to almost come from infinity. And the image will be the extrapolation of those points and where those rays meet. And you can see that the image looks way bigger than what you can get at your near point. If you imagine it being at infinity, if you imagine the image at infinity, you get the lower right-hand drawing for page 18. So notice that if you look at the leaf at your 25 centimeters on the left-hand lower part of page 18, it subtends an angle theta. If you look at the angle subtended by the image on the lower part of page 18 on the right, that's given by angle theta prime. The ratio of those two angles is the magnification. Or another way to think about it is the magnification is going to be the near point for your eye divided by the focal length of the magnifying lens. So this is a useful thing to know. One of the reasons this is useful is because many optical instruments basically are made up of two lenses, and one of those lenses more or less acts as a magnifier. And an example is a refracting telescope where you're observing, so this is now page 19, where you're observing an object at infinity, so that means that the rays are coming in parallel, and those rays, since they're coming in from infinity, will be focused at the focal point for the objective, which in this case is F sub O. You then take another converging lens, which is often called the eyepiece. You can think of it also as just the magnifying glass. And you place the eyepiece such that the focal length of the eyepiece is very close to the focal length of the object. Now it acts very much like a magnifying glass on the image from the objective, and you see a big image. In this case, it's inverted. So note that the image of the first lens is the object of the second lens, and you have to do the analysis accordingly when you're trying to do these types of, when trying to do multiple lens problems. Just in the spirit of looking at different elements, there, I am not talking at all in this course about curved mirrors. There is, you can use mirrors, spherical mirrors, to do many of the same things that you can do with thin lenses. In most textbooks, you'll find a chapter on spherical mirrors and a chapter on thin lenses, and it turns out that they really are pretty similar sorts of treatments, so I only really talk about thin lenses, but if you're interested in mirrors, you can go look at the mirror chapter. But mirrors with curvature can also focus rays of light, and you often see configurations like what you see here in A and B. And basically, A is a Newtonian telescope, and B is Schmidt-Cassegrain optics, I think. Okay, this is actually important for astronomy because it turns out to be practically much cheaper to build and practical to build large mirrors than it is to build large objective lenses. The lenses are very thick, and it's hard to make the glass so perfect, and not trivial to do mirrors, but it's easier to do mirrors than lenses. Of course, your ability to do astronomy, you have to see dimmer and dimmer objects, and you need to have good resolution. So you need to collect a lot of light, and in doing so, you need to be able to resolve objects that are very small. So it turns out that size is very important in this, and there are practical difficulties with constructing single mirrors that are really, really large. So some of the biggest advances in astronomy, most recently the technology, has been actually learning how to make multiple mirror telescopes act like single big mirrors. And more than that, if you go to page 22, people have learned now how to take multiple telescopes and basically use them as if they were points on a single big telescope to get better resolution on objects. Another big problem is that in the atmosphere between us and space, you have lots of fluctuations in the index of refraction. I mean, you may think the index of refraction of air is air. Well, hot air and cold air have different indices of refraction. Thin air and more dense air have different indices of refraction. So you have lots of movement in the atmosphere giving you lots of different indices of refraction. as a function of time, as a function of position, and this will distort images for telescopes that are on the ground. So one way to avoid this, in page 23, is to actually go out into space to avoid the atmospheric distortions. People have developed a technology that allows them to actually correct largely for atmospheric distortions, and this has been used quite a bit. I'm not an expert on that. I believe it involves basically sending a beam of light up in the air and using it to calibrate the distortions that you should be expecting to see for the light that's coming down. But I'm not expert enough to even explain that well, I think. Another compound lens device that's very useful to know something about is a compound microscope. And in this case, again, you have the object, and you create an image using the objective lens, which is, in this case, you have the object reasonably some distance outside the focal length of the objective lens, and you now put the eyepiece such that it again magnifies the image created by the objective, and you see a larger image. On page 25, this is a basic cutaway of a single lens reflex camera showing the rather complex optics involved in a real camera. But if you go to page 26, you can see sort of a schematic. The idea here is you have a lens, you have an opening that can vary in size, you have a shutter which opens and closes given a certain amount of time, and you have film. You need a certain amount of light to make a good image, and you can't get that light just by integrating over time because objects move during time. So you have a big trade-off of various things: size of opening, time of exposure, and how much things are moving. The speed, you typically will have shutter speed, and you will also have what is known as the f-stop, which is the ratio of the focal length of the lens to the diameter or the opening of this iris diaphragm. And those are called f-stops, and each f-stop that you crank the lens up or down, you're changing the light intensity by a factor of 2. So if the object is moving very, very fast, then you need brighter light and less time, because if the day is very dark, for example, you're going to need a slower speed because you have to integrate more light, or a larger diameter, you have to let in more light. If you have a larger diameter, it turns out that you're letting in light from bigger and bigger radii, and what that will end up doing is it will actually narrow the field of focus of the camera. So just to show you what I mean, go to page 27. These are pictures that I took with a single lens reflex, just pointing it out the window of my office. And on the left hand side, I set it so that it has a fairly slow exposure time, and you can tell in part it's slow because things fuzzed out a little bit in terms of the tree and the squirrel that you see in the tree, which it is focused on, but my hand is actually just the basic motion of my hand shaking fuzzed it out a tiny bit because it had a large exposure time. But because it had a large exposure time, I had the diameter of the opening very small. So what this means is that I have a very wide focus, a very deep range of focus. So you note that the tree is basically in focus, and you'll also note that the columns on the building way back on the other side of the quad are also sort of in focus, okay? If, on the other hand, and I took the next picture, you know, just a second after the first one, if I now change it such that I take a fast time and I have a very large opening, note that it has blurred out the columns in the back, and the tree still looks fairly sharp. The tree looks a little sharper because I no longer have the hand motion. But note that artistically, these are really very different pictures. So if you want to do photography, for example, getting some feeling for how these various elements of opening versus time versus f-stop and available light, you know, allows you to do different things with the different sorts of pictures. And it's sort of fun. Any rate, maybe I will supplement this with a nice demo, which will do if allowed to do so, given the time available for the projects presentations next week. I might also, if I don't think I can do that, I may take some pictures of a demo of some optical stuff that's sort of fun. At any rate, I think that's about it for the geometric optics. Be sure to do the geometric optics problems. The stuff's not hard, but you really do have to do it. You really do have to get used to the conventions, and you need to get used to how to do ray diagrams and how to do multiple lens problems. The fact that the image of the first lens is the object for the second lens calculation, and you iterate down amongst the lenses. And sometimes it can be a little tricky to keep all the object and image distances and convention signs straight and those types of problems. So you definitely really want to practice that. So, anyway, I guess that's it for me this class. I really enjoyed your class. And, well, I guess we'll do presentations next week. And then we've got the final on December 19th. So, thanks for listening. Bye.